My name is David Cowan, and I'm based at Emmanuel College in Cambridge. I work on the history of 20th century Britain, on class and politics and memory. So in terms of schools, I'm really interested in how the expansion of education has changed people's class identities, where they place themselves in society, and also in how this has changed their ideas about big political debates, which political parties they've supported. And how all this relates to people's memories of a period in the past when education has not been quite so widespread. So, schooling is a long and important period in children's lives, and it has been since the Second World War. I think historians know that almost everyone has recognised how much education has the capacity to change children's lives, parents and politicians and teachers and pupils themselves. But often these groups haven't always sought the same things out of education, and that I think is why it's been so important to study. And after the war, the extent to which schools really do alter children's lives in terms of things like the jobs that they take on after it, that hasn't been the same for every person. The opportunities for education to allow children to take on jobs that are quite different from their own parents are not wholly equal. And that's one big reason why historians of class are interested in education. But to put more concretely, to draw from my own research, I've looked at children from working class families in the middle of the 20th century who've gone through selective state education and have moved on to non-manual jobs, becoming things like teachers. And if you listen to their parents, there's a great deal of pride in their children. There's gratitude that their children are securely employed where their parents had not necessarily been at a similar stage in their lives. But there's also a measure of worry and uncertainty about what this means for some of the values that the parents had sought to instill in their children. The sort of values that they now see slipping away as the children are mixing with different people through education and eventually taking on different jobs to their parents. I think one way in which class has influenced the school experience and outcomes of different children is about the perceptions and reality of who attend in different schools, and the experienced environments that were often quite different to the ones that they were brought up in. So one important thing to remember throughout this period is the continued existence of a small but important sector of private non-state education. Broadly, this, as you'd imagine, this favours the children of richer families. And although there were a big range of experiences of private education, this has a big influence over children's experiences. The facilities their school has are different in a fee-paying school. This changes whether they return home every afternoon or whether they live in their school and board during term time. It shapes what uniforms they wear, and it shapes, perhaps most importantly for thinking about class, how similar their friends' backgrounds are to theirs. And then in the state non-fee-paying sector, shortly after the war, there's a tripartite system where very few go to technical schools, but most go to secondary modern, and then a minority go to a grammar school. And there are again important differences between the experiences of children in these different schools, but we can pick out some important ones, like the grammar schools compared to secondary moderns are a bit more like the public schools in terms of the uniforms that they ask their children to wear. Now, those that go to grammar schools are supposed to have been selected based on academic ability. It's a test known as the 11 plus. And the hope after the war is that this test would do a good job at helping working class children into the more academic grammar schools. And some certainly do make that move. But there are also problems with the test. It's clear that children of those who'd been to grammar school themselves, often, though not always, children of middle class parents, tend to be better prepared, and sometimes formally are better prepared to pass the test and proceed and get to go to grammar school. So, in this sense, many of the existing class differences in society carry on through the school system, just in terms of who attends different schools. But it's true that subsequently the principle of comprehensive education changes this, and the state-funded grammar school, one with academic selection, largely, though not entirely, dies out. So all these differences shape children's trajectories during and after school, and class in many ways shapes how long they stay at school for, as with many working class children in the grammar schools, and it shapes whether they feel welcome and whether they academically prosper. It also shapes where people end up after leaving school, whether they go on to attend university and do well there, and what jobs they take on. One source that historians of education use to explore questions about class are autobiographies and memoirs, often written in later life, so some decades after people finish school. But we need to be careful that to remember that not everyone writes an autobiography and gets it published. It's often people who've become notable in some way, as politicians or celebrities, for instance. And so while their memories might be very revealing, we shouldn't necessarily assume that their experiences were typical. So we know that many famous journalists and writers after the Second World War had been born in working class families and had gone through grammar school. But we also know that many of their friends at primary school will not have something that they reflect on. So there are luckily a broader range of sources that historians might draw on to try and get more typical or more varied experiences of the relationships between class and schooling, not all of which end up in grammar school and celebrity and fame. And we're fortunate that historians have not been the first people to explore these questions. In many ways, they're building on the research of people that were interested in questions about social mobility and about the impact of education on the class structure at the time. People like documentary filmmakers and academic sociologists, so people who are interested in studying and representing present society. Now, this clip comes from a television documentary series which started in the early 1960s. It's been repeated with some of the same children every 7 years since, as they grew older and became adults. And the great advantage of a source like this is that we get to hear from children at the time that they were in school, without any potentially distorting effects of them looking back from years later. But we do need to remember that it's not like a CCTV camera was placed in a classroom. These children were speaking to a filmmaker, and that's an unusual experience that might have encouraged them to speak and perform in certain ways. And at the same time, what we have access to here is a selection of clips that the filmmaker has put together to illustrate an argument about class. As the voiceover says, here it's about how much of a role post-war schooling played in shaping who children encountered in the rest of their lives. And so what might at first look like these children speaking to us directly has of course been filtered in certain ways before we get it. But it's really important as a video that we can hear the children speak. And many British people will watch this and think they can hear differences between the different groups of children. Britain accent is one of the things that we often associate with class when we think about the idea of what's posh, for instance.
When I leave the school, I'm going to College Court. And then I will be going to Westminster Boarding School if I pass the exam. And then we think I'm going to Cambridge and Trinity Hall.
What does university mean?
Well, before I'm old enough to get a job, I just walk around and see what I can find.
When I leave the school, I go to Broadstairs, St. Peter's Court. Then after that, I'm going to Charterhouse. And after that, Trinity Hall, Cambridge.
So we could see this as a reflection of the different intakes of the schools, but we could also argue that this was perhaps, particularly with private education, a product of schooling, of mixing between children and people subtly and perhaps unconsciously conforming to their peers. But the video is also really important because it offers us some insights into what class meant for the children's feelings about their own futures. If we compare how the children talk about the rest of their lives, one thing that I think sticks out is the relative certainty of the children in private education about what will follow. They seem to know exactly what will lie ahead, like there's a neat roadmap laid out in front. And it does include some stages where they might not progress as they intend. And one of the boys says this, that it's about passing an exam, which he knows that he might not. But we can say that in practice, these boys did stand a better chance of fulfilling these steps than the other boys, in large part because of the advantages in preparation for assessments and other things that private education in the 60s conferred. So there's a confidence in themselves and in their futures, and they're not entirely wrong to have that. We might get the sense that this is sort of a well-trodden path that their parents had taken before them. And in that sense, through education, they're likely to maintain the same class as their parents, to be as rich and to be as well connected. But confidence isn't the only difference. It's also that the boys at the private school have information, probably from their parents, that the other boys don't. For the children at the private schools, there's a clear series of hoops to go through. And in some ways, it's this knowledge that partly helps pave the way for them. Whereas for the other boys, and it's not their parents' fault by any means, they don't necessarily have the same information and the same opportunities don't necessarily present themselves. We know from other sources from this period that not everyone is equally aware of practical supports like the government funding that was available at the time to support students attending university. So it's not to say that the boys at the state schools won't be able to go to grammar school or onto university and won't be able to move into better paid jobs like being a lawyer. It's just that they'll need considerably more luck than children of the same age that are educated at a fee-paying school. This extract comes from a research study which was conducted in 1959 and 1960. The authors wanted to find out how grammar school had affected the minority of working class children who'd gone through it, including themselves. And they did this not by interviewing school pupils while they were still at school, and so they spoke to them as adults once they had left, and so they were looking back on their childhoods. This might seem like a bit of a challenge when using this source, and it's true that we lose some of the immediacy that you might get when interviewing people while they're still at school. But arguably, it's also clear, even from this short extract, how much these people feel like school has affected them, how much the memories have stayed with them into adulthood, and that conclusion's of great importance to historians. Some of the big questions the researchers were asking were things like, did grammar school help them in adult life? But probably the biggest question of all, and one this extract gets at, is what did it mean to move working class children from one environment with a particular set of norms and values to a potentially very different environment, one dominated by the middle class? How far do they fit in? Was there a level playing field for them to do well and to enjoy school? The extract's about the first few weeks they spent at a grammar school, and so it's worth remembering that some of their experiences will have been different subsequently. Did the authors tell us later that some of the working class children do eventually adjust quite well? Though often, as they say, it's at the cost of losing contact with their friends in primary school who don't make the same educational move that they have done. But actually, many of the working class children at grammar school find this is unfortunately their experience of secondary education. It's alienating. It caters very well for the middle class peers, but often less well for the working class, who don't appear as confident, as the source says, in an environment that's very familiar to their classmates. It's like there's a set of codes that children brought up in certain privileged environments, whose parents have been to similar schools, get. And it's like they don't get these codes themselves. And we get another sense from this source of an additional challenge for working class children, that with a bit less money, their parents have to get the uniforms which they will grow into, which further sets them apart from their peers, whose parents can afford to replace the uniforms more regularly. So overall, in this source, there's an impression that grammar schooling in the middle of the 20th century does not act as a social leveller entirely for those that have been academically selected. And that's ignoring the further question of who actually gets to attend grammar schools. From this source, we might suggest that those selected state education offered the scope to readjust the class structure, to let academically talented work children from the working class ascend into middle class jobs. It also put considerable barriers in their way. These are great sources for revealing the sheer diversity of people's experiences of secondary education after the Second World War, and not just by school type, but by pupils of different backgrounds within the same school type. In another way, the sources suggest that particular forms of privileged knowledge, as much as maybe differences of wealth between parents, have gone some way to explain the continuation of class-based educational inequalities in the second half of the 20th century. Maybe they suggest as well that class was never just then about dividing up society into neat occupational groupings, but also about people's knowledge and their connections. And one final conclusion that we might draw is that there are real benefits to exploring both people's testimonies of school at the time as they go through it, as well as thinking about the retrospective accounts of school and how that's changed their memories of school life.